Good evening, everyone, and happy Shabbat to one and all. I can see that we have Larry and JB with us. We did have Kirk during the observation show, so maybe he's having weather-related problems. But how are you, fellas?
Doing good.
Doing good.
Great. Good. What we talked about today during the observation show is we finally made our way to the section in Proverbs 7 where there appears to be a change of voice. And up to that point, what we had come to realize is that God was giving us a real treasure. I mean, he was handing us the head of Christianity on a silver platter. Now, he began this whole thing by saying, you know, if you want to live, if you want to get the most out of life, observe my Torah and pay special attention to the terms and conditions of the covenant. Well, that alone destroys the credibility of Christianity. You can't have a religion of Christianity if the Torah is viable. So then he goes through all of the antidote for Christianity and really how we should go about this this whole process of protecting ourselves from religion. And then he says, right outside of my window, I saw the whore. And with the whore were a bunch of dimwits, unthinking idiots. And I paid special attention. I made the connection. Leading that parade was a young man. Gee, I wonder who that would be, particularly since when you read Daniel and then Revelation, there is no mistaking the fact that the whore of Babylon is the Roman Catholic Church. So who is the person who has the most to do with the creation of the religion of Christianity?
Apollos.
There you go.
Sheol.
And whose name is found at the end of this proverb?
Sheol.
Right.
He describes Christianity, he lays Christianity out, he talks about the consequences of Christianity, and then he says, and here he is, Sheol. And yet even today, I've got some guy off some, I don't know, wannabe messianic and half Christian talking about how Paul is misunderstood, and look at my website. I went to his webpage, and guess what? In big, bold letters, guess what jumped right out at me? Yeshua HaMashiach! Right away.
Yeah.
I said, well, this is a poison religious bullshit website. I mean, the second I saw it, I said, we need go no further. He made 5 points to a person I know, and I answered all 5 of them with Yahweh's words.
Yeah.
And he was wrong about each and every single point. In fact, you don't even have to go into the doorway at Pesach. It just means Passover. That's all it is. Just means Passover.
Right.
Yeah, like death passing you over, idiot. You know, but you can't get through to these people. You know,
Whatever. And religion makes somebody stupid.
Okay.
That's why God said twice in the material we've already covered, I can't comprehend them. I can't endure being around them. And I can't save them. So it's just the way it is. You know, it's interesting, of course, about the name Yeshua. There is a zero possibility that the first 2 letters in Yahweh's name are pronounced Yeh. It's from the verb Haya. There aren't any Jew on the planet that doesn't know how to pronounce Haya. You know, it is Yah. And he came in his father's name. The name Yahusha is written no fewer than 222 times in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms.
And it's not just that. He said he's awesome and astonishing on the account of my name. My name will be on him.
Of course.
You know, it's like when I go out and I buy matzah crackers, because I'm not much of a baker, so I have to buy them. And I go out and I buy something called Yehudi, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I guess they're related to Yeh. you know, not to God.
Yeah, of course.
And it's sad.
And and this Hamathiach, do you know how many times that Hamathiach appears in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms?
The definite article, even the Masiyah is never written, let alone the Hamathiach.
Yeah. Would you like to know how many times Masiyah is used in the Torah, Prophets,
and Psalms? I already know, two times.
As a noun.
Never as a noun.
Never
as a noun. Is it possible to have a title be an adjective or an adverb?
No.
No, it isn't. So I want to tell you, in the entirety of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, not only doesn't Hamathiach ever appear, Masiyach is never used as a noun. It's not a title.
No, Masiyach is used as a name, is what
right.
It's used as.
Yeah, the only reason that it now is acclaimed is because Christianity, rather than using the Masiyach,
implement of Yahweh,
or Masiyah, as a matter of fact,
they want to go Messiah and get rid of Yah, sure.
Yeah, I think there's some place along the way that Yosha probably did acknowledge when Shimon Kefesh said, you know, you are the Masiyah, which means that you are the work of Yah. You are Yah working in our presence. That he would have admitted, yes, I am Yahweh working to fulfill the promises that I made regarding the covenant. And so as a identity designation, as a statement of purpose, the actual name is fine. But Christianity then thinking that God spoke Greek somehow, that God was somehow a Greek. Why? Because the Greeks were really cool. That he's going to have a Greek name and he's going to have a Greek title, and they came up with Christ, and so now the religious types that have tried to blend Pauline Christianity, that poison, disgusting human being, and rabbinical Judaism have, you know, it's for them, it's Yeshua, purely rabbinical, Hamasiach, a complete and utter fabrication.
Well, this guy did say Yah, but he said he said just like much like the clowns that were ascribing matzah to being cleaning up a lot of breadcrumbs. He said that you know, he said Yahushua, so it's Shua, not Yahusha. But we know Yahusha means salvation, and you know.
Yeah, and by the way,
you know, you want to do this Shua thing.
Of the 224 times it appears, it is written
twice.
Yahushua, twice, and that name means Yah cries out.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yah cries. That's a far cry from Yahweh saving.
Yeah, which he denotes in Hosea. He says, "I'm the only Savior."
Everybody knows that Yosha, that as it appears in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, is the same name that Yosha ben Yahweh. So Yosha ben Nun came in the same name as Yosha ben Yahweh. Do you have any idea why we are never told explicitly that Yosha ben Nun is the same name that will be used for Yosha ben Yahweh? Why do you think? I think
you have to, so you can think.
We're never told.
So you can think. that might help, you know.
Yeah, because God doesn't like giving you answers on a platter. He does want you to think. And I think it is because, A, God only has one name. So if I'm right about that, Yahweh only has one name, and that's what he says. So I don't think I'm out on a limb to say Yahweh has only one name. If he has only one name, then Yahusha really isn't a name. It is a descriptive phrase.
Yeah, of his mission, of who he is. Yahweh says.
Right.
It's just Yahusha Yah written backwards.
Correct. It is a descriptive phrase, not a name. Because God only has one name. God does not want us to refer to him as Yahusha.
He wants us to realize Yahweh saves. Yeah.
Right, so there's no reason for Yahweh to proclaim the name of the diminished manifestation of Yahweh engaged in the process of fulfilling the promises of the covenant, because that's not his name. That is a
I think that's
of what he's doing for us.
That's also a great reason why Dode said he hated people with divided loyalties. You know, there's you got to understand,
right,
for every covenant member, there's 10 of them, 100 of them out there that they find the name. It's never Yahusha. It's, you know, if they say that, they're always in good company. It's always Yeshua or Yahshua. And if they come off with the Yahshua thing, what I found is they're focused. It's almost they're so focused. They will quote New Testaments. They're carrying a New Testament.
Of course.
Right. They will deny that that's what they do, but they're always going into this, into that, into this. They've never looked at extant word studies of Yahweh's, and they don't really have an interest in it either, apparently.
No.
You know.
So, now, I'm going to tell you the second reason I don't think that we were ever told that that the description, the descriptive name of Yahweh in the process of saving us is Yahusha. And that is because I don't think that was Yahweh's primary purpose. I don't think that he came to save us.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
At least not.
Yeah,
that was a side effect. That was a, you know, it happened,
right,
but that was
right,
not the primary purpose at all.
Right, right. The primary purpose was to fulfill the promises that he made regarding the covenant, which is why he enabled and fulfilled the first four of the Moed Mikre, because the first four Moed Mikre provide all five benefits of the covenant. I think it's as simple as that.
Right, but and at the same time, and that was quite a realization. I remember when you came to that about 3 years ago, it made total sense because you asked me, and I said, huh. You remember you asked me, and I said, I thought that, well, you know, it's, the only thing I can think is that, you know, the fall of man is designed to coincide with the fall of Mikre, which is true,
yeah,
but that's not really the point. The point was, that's why Hoshea was saying, where's your sting
because,
now?
Right, because Yahweh was committed to honoring the promises he had made regarding the benefits of the covenant. And he did it by enabling the first four Moed Mikre. That's the reason that they were fulfilled. And so, since that would be a rather elongated name or job description, he just simply chose Yahusha. Now, Yahusha, while it is the Hebrew verb to save, it also means to deliver, to rescue. And I do look at the benefits of the covenant as God rescuing us. He rescued Abraham from Babylon. He rescued us from Egypt, from the crucible. I think we are rescued and delivered from humankind to the safety of Yahweh's home. And that kind of deliverance and rescue, I think, is entirely appropriate. As for salvation, it's such a meaningless aspect of the benefits of the covenant that it's hardly worth mentioning.
Well, you know, when you start talking about salvation, and we've talked about this before, salvation is such a bare minimum when you're talking about going into new dimensions that don't include time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, things that I can't
fathom. Scott Burdink, who's was the co-host and producer of Shattering Myths for all those years. He is a
I know Scott.
He is a tight end as a football player. He's
right
6'5", I think. Tremendous athlete, great basketball player. He's a tough guy. He's a man's man. You know he cried today. You know he cried today.
No, I didn't. But
there was something. This is before we get back into Proverbs 7. There's something I shared that really didn't dawn on me until I was writing this most recent chapter, 7, of Yahusha. And I shared it during the observations program. And
you're talking about the choice?
I want to go over it again because it had a profound impact on me. And if it had the same influence on Scott, then it might on everyone. And that is...
Well, I doubt if it will on Dennis Treacy, but we can try. But
okay.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. So we have Iowa providing some instruction to Adam. And at this point, it's just Adam. But he says, hey, Adam, you can eat to your heart's content. You can eat until you're just absolutely satiated from absolutely every tree in the garden. And from the tree of the knowledge, which is really actually anti-political correctness. It's not knowledge. It's the ability to be discriminating, discerning, to be effectively judgmental, and process information so as to render a rational conclusion. It's the Hebrew word dayat, which means to process information in such a way that you can be discriminating and discerning. So the tree of discrimination, of discernment, of thinking, of that which is beneficial and helpful and productive, and that which is counterproductive and misleading and deceitful. So he said, you can eat everything you want, every tree in the garden, and of that one tree, that discerning tree, I would encourage you not to eat from that tree. Because if you eat from it, you're going to die. Now, that was profound in and of itself, in that, you know, what does that tree represent? Well, that tree represents choice. You know, if Yahweh had created us, I'm not to the point yet that really brings some, at least brought both Scott and I to tears, and I'll get to it, but I wanted to set it up in the right context. What that tree represents is choice. Adam was there with Yahweh, and Yahweh had to have at least a condition, an option, where Adam could choose not Yahweh. That tree was there for that. The tree wasn't, you know, evil in and of itself. The tree had both good and evil in it. That tree was the tree of discernment, of being able to rationally think things through. And he just said, you can eat anything you want of that one tree, though. You know, if you eat of it, you know, you're going to die. And so that tree existed for a sole purpose, the purpose of not Yahweh. Otherwise, Adam is not a companion in a loving relationship. He is instead akin to a slave. He has no free will. Now, this is the part that really got my attention. You know, in the same breath, and I don't think there's one in a million people that have made this connection. In the very same breath, after telling Adam that, what does God say next? I think we have Kirk with us now. Hi, Kirk. Oh, you were on that 111 number, so you were here the whole time.
Apparently, I kept saying I'm not there, so I kept pushing one and threw that out.
Okay. Hey, oh, all right. Now I get it. Okay. So, Kirk, in the very same breath that Yahweh provides the choice of not Yahweh, what does he say?
He said that's the part about he's going to give him Yahweh.
Yeah. I'm going to give you a woman.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you a really sexy.
A really
first
hot
rate.
Woman. Wow.
Really attractive option that doesn't necessarily exclude me, but gives you an opportunity to have someone who is really, really ideally suited for you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why did he do that? Why is it in the same breath as the choice to exclude Yahweh from your life?
It has to be a compelling choice.
Well, that's
and it has to be a human choice. In my opinion,
well,
it has to be a human choice.
Here's the bottom line. Larry? Is there somebody that you know used to be a Republican zealot? You were once in charge of a county there in Florida for the Republican Party. Is there anybody that you met along the way that you were somewhat enamored with at the time, but you after a while you decided maybe this is not the best person for me to work my
absolutely.
Okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what if the choice was, for the rest of your life, for all eternity, to have absolutely no one to talk to. You are completely and totally alone. Or you could occasionally, when you felt like it, strike up a conversation with the guy that you once had a relationship with, but, you know, just wasn't quite your cup of tea. Which would you choose?
I'd choose the latter of the two.
Yeah. And so would 100% of humans.
We
literally go insane. Solitary confinement, we go insane. There isn't a human on the planet that can survive it. And so if the choice that Yahweh gave us was total and complete loneliness, complete and utter isolation, or Yahweh, of course everyone's going to choose Yahweh, but not because it is what they want, not because they like him, not because of anything other than...
It's because there's no choice involved.
Yeah, not to Yahweh is to go insane, is to be so horribly bored as to just want to die. And so what God did is gave man someone like him, someone unbelievably beautiful and attractive and perfectly designed for him, so that if he wanted to reject Yahweh's instructions, he would be alone.
That's really profound, you know.
Really, really profound. What that does is that makes God, who created this entire universe and authored life and went to all of this trouble expressly because he wanted to have a relationship with Adam, extraordinary.
Yeah.
It makes him one unbelievably cool dude, man.
Yeah.
You don't get any better than what he did. Now, what's also interesting is that beyond what it did for Adam, it sets up all of humankind thereafter. Now all of us have this option. It's not total isolation or God. It's Yahweh or an allegiance with many of the human institutions of society or religion or militarism or religion. Religion, politics, militarism, or societal customs. We all now have that same option. It is really compelling, interesting options with our fellow man if we choose not God. And so this whole thing that Yahweh is offering us is the choice to deliver us from that second option, because it got us in so much trouble. But yet, where would we be even now? Let's say the covenant was only, I'll just use my own self. If the covenant was just me and Yahweh, you know, we'd have a good old time. But the amount of fun that we would have, the enjoyment we would have, would be 1/1 billionth of what we are having when we share this experience with other family members.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing.
Right.
So God provided a choice that ultimately ended up with an ideal result. Thousands of people will be part of his family for all eternity who chose this because they liked Yahweh. They respected him. They respected the offer, and they acted based upon his advice. Well, that's a marvelous, marvelous scenario that he established. All right, so that being the case, I do want to return to Proverbs 7. So after telling us that Paul, the founder of the Christian religion, would be possessed by the whore, controlled by the whore, and used by the whore. In fact, it says this, so I'll just use God's words. And she, the whore, establishes her influence over him, harshly overpowering and binding him. Binding is the Hebrew, closest Hebrew word to religion. Then she makes him submit to her, brazenly and shamelessly possessing and oppressing him with her presence, demon possessing her, and her improper aggrandizing sayings, which are directed towards him. You know, Paul, everything was, but I, Paul, say, and not just in the ego of Paul, but Paul became just like Satan. Just like Muhammad became just like Satan. Perverted, twisted, corrupt, and astonishingly egotistical. You know, they were the messenger of God. It just so happened that their God was the Lord. This tells us exactly how Satan came to control Paul. Now, this brings us to 7:14. There is a change of voice. And perhaps perspective, beginning with Proverbs 7:14. So, Yahweh began by addressing his children in first person. He continued to do so through the seventh verse. But then throughout the intervening six verses, God's viewpoint changed to reflect the alluring and adversarial ways of the whore of religion. As a result, we are left with two options, both plausible, which I have concluded was the intent. If the following is in God's voice, then it shows Yahweh acknowledging that he has personally paid the price to reconcile our relationship with him, and that by doing so, he honored, satisfied, and fulfilled the sworn promises he made to us in his Torah. This would therefore be in contrast to the whore of religion, who is offering nothing in value. However, since the following presentation isn't entirely consistent with the Yahweh's plan and nature, ever so subtle corruptions of it, even with the most favorable interpretation of the words and their definitions, God may actually be revealing the strategy the whore has deployed to make the religion of Christianity seem believable by having it mirror the truth, just inverting it. So if this portion of the story is religious, and I think it is, it is in Satan's voice. Now, there are several reasons I'd like to present this discussion from God's viewpoint and then from Satan's. First, I am personally convinced now that it is Satan's perspective that is being shared here, but I'm convinced that it is so subtle because God wants to make the point that Satan doesn't create, that Satan simply counterfeits what God has said, so that all of Satan's religious doctrines are simply tweaks on what Yahweh said, just enough to make it fake. So I think that is what's happening here. But, you know, I have never and will never say that I am inerrant and therefore that you have to read it the same way that I'm going to share it with you. I think it's much wiser to lay it out and say, here it is both ways, you make your call. But that's the conclusion that I've come to. Now, throughout this entire section, there's something that is unique, and that is that the pronouns, like this pronouns all the way through up to this, the last six verses, which have the whore manipulating the lone individual man, Paul, the pronouns were all either she or he. Now we move into a section where the pronouns are all common, which means they're undetermined. They're neither feminine nor masculine. So that change ought to tell you something. And there is reason to suspect that it was written this way in order to demonstrate the allure of Satan, to explain how the devil masquerades as God, to manipulate people into worshiping him, showing how the whore's religious counterfeit could easily be misinterpreted so that people think they're worshiping God as the Lord when in fact they're bowing down to Satan. So, I think this is confusing for the very reason that religion is designed to confuse. It's based on Babel, the Hebrew word for confusion. Therefore, God is exposing us to the whore's favorite tactic.
But don't you think he said that so we would know, we'd recognize the anti-Torah, or the Torahless one? I mean, isn't that what he's...
the Torahless one's going to do exactly the same thing.
And he's going to be exactly like this.
Mm-hmm.
So here's your warning.
Christianity is exactly like this. Paul is exactly like this. Yeah, I think so. But I also think that when you're dealing, you know, Paul and Muhammad both were never up front. They were always pussyfooting around. They were always trying to dance between raindrops. They were they wanted to convey their antagonism for Jews and for the Torah and for the covenant and for Yahweh without just being black and white about it. And so, you know, you really have to understand the Quran to expose and condemn it. The same thing is true with Paul's letters. Paul's letters, a few places, come right out and say it, but most of the time, Paul's, you know, dances around. And so, yeah, that's just the way that Satan operates. But if, when deceit deceives in this way, you really got to be on your game to figure it out. I mean, you could give an accurate translation of this to 1,000 Christians, and not one would see Paul in it.
It's stunning, but that's true.
It's true. This is subtle. Religion is subtle. It's designed to be subtle. You know, when I was dealing with, and I had reason to deal with Satan's first encounter with Chawa yesterday, because I was translating the last sentence in Yashaya, the second chapter, and it uses a term. It uses Nesama, which doesn't appear very often, but Nesama was right there, and it was off Nesama. And God was telling us to stay away from everyone who has an off Nesama. And I'm saying, what in the world is an off
Poor Nesama? Judgment skills. I mean,
and so I decided to track down how Yahweh defines alt, because I was looking up in the lexicons. And
how do you spell
it? You know, and you know, you really have to scratch your head to make sense of it in the lexicon. So what I found is the very first time that Satan goes to Chawa, he's allowed into the garden, he opens his mouth, and he begins to talk to Chawa. You know what the first word that he uses? The first word out of Satan's mouth. Off. Very first word he
used, of course.
Yeah, off. And so I developed an understanding of what Satan was doing and why an off Nesama was such a terrible thing that we had to stay away from. And it's all because of hypotheticals and equivocations that are presented from a attitude of resentment that instill an angry response. It's why, you know, you mention Yahweh's Torah and Christians respond angrily. You know, Paul created these hypotheticals surrounding the Torah and its covenant that caused people to resent God because he resented God. And that's the nature of Amph. And so I was, it all ties here to together. So you really have to realize that if you're going to get involved in a translation, you got to take your time. You got to think through the words. You can't be a slave to the lexicons and just say, well, you know, Amph means notwithstanding or nonetheless or
yeah, right. I mean, yeah, that's, you know, there was a religious group that caused a big problem, especially with me, that I'm kind of embarrassed about, because I went nuts because I thought, and I have to apologize to both Richard and JB, I thought they were siding with them, just the way that the emails were presented. I was like, are you kidding me? You know, the point that I'm making here is that there was a group there that said that they may agree with some of Craig's translations and then admitted to walking around thumping a Bible. Well, you know, Yahweh tells us not to use the published Christian material for a reason, doesn't he?
Right. Yeah, it does.
And if you think you can fix it with three or four concordances that all go back to the most recent corruption two or three times each, then think that you can do what Yahweh told you not even to try to attempt to do, which is to fix a Bible. You're not supposed to be reading out of them, folks.
No,
that's just the way it is.
If you try to read a New Testament, Yeah, that's all. It's really hopeful.
Well, you know what? I've seen the Old Testament too, and as far as I'm concerned, you can call a Christian Old Testament an Old Testament. It's trash, 90% of it anyway. It's just a lot of religious sounding tripe. It's not even real. The words aren't even there that are supposed to be there.
2 chapters ago, I spent a good part of the chapter trying to compare my translations to what appeared in Christian translations of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And oh my goodness, it is just, there really is almost no tangible connection between the words as they appear and what you read in an English translation. They are very problematic. Now, that is not to say that mine are perfect. I would never make that claim. There is, you know, each time I go through them, I try to make them better, and they're as good as I'm capable of making them. And they're at least an honest effort in trying to convey what God said as completely and as accurately as is possible with the tools that we have available to us.
Honest effort. The religious translators don't even put an honest effort into it. They don't put an effort
into
it.
No, they don't.
Well,
they
you know, see, here's the problem. You cannot go to a sewer and clean it up. I mean, you just can't.
Now, but on this deal with JB and with Richard, I did read JB's letter, and I thought it was really quite thoughtful. I didn't see JB taking sides. I just saw JB.
No, it was just something.
I want to interject him to the this issue and share my thoughts, but he wasn't taking any sides. And then I read Richard's, and Richard has learned to write, man. I mean, I just learned to write sounds like he couldn't write previously. He's always been a writer, but man, does he write beautifully. I don't know if it was yesterday or today, I read what he wrote, and I was in stitches laughing, first of all, because it's really funny.
That's true.
Man,
he's much more eloquent than he gives himself credit for.
I saw it all out of context is my problem.
Yeah, but I read the first comment that I read to Richard. I wrote a response back, and I was hoping that Richard would see that I was agreeing with him, even though I used Richard as the example, because Richard says that, you know, that he is embarrassed by the fact that way too often, he uses less than ideal language. And so... I waited in on the language side of it, and I shared, you know, my viewpoints on language, why I don't use certain words. Although occasionally I do, but when I use them, it's almost always in private. It's almost always the same circumstance. Some idiot on television or on the radio says something that is not just untrue, but is extraordinarily damaging to people to hear. And I, you know, sometimes I'm just sitting there alone, and I'll say it. I feel badly about saying it because it doesn't accomplish anything. But
whatever, I don't feel bad.
Richard's comments were actually supportive of the position that we were all trying to take. But Richard's letter today says, "Gosh, come on, folks, don't get all tied up in a word when you're in an environment where they." Great preponderance of the words are being conveyed in such a way that they aren't anywhere else in the world, and you can actually get to know who Yahweh is and what he's offering, and to reject that because one word in 1,000 is irritating to you, it probably is not a good choice. But that's how I read, Richard's reply today. But I even got a letter today from Sharon.
All they took
right
away
from
that show was that one thing.
Yeah, and you know,
that was all they took away.
Yeah, from Sharon today that I didn't pass along to everybody else, but it was actually quite lovely. It was really a very, very, very nice letter that I received from her today. So I hopefully the whole thing is just. All right.
We
survived it, and the important thing here is that you've just done something that is important to us, which is that we need to make certain that to the greatest extent possible, while we all realize we have some flaws, you know, JB and Richard and Kirk and Scott and you, Larry, and Jackie, and so many others are extremely important to the family. Constantly involved in the process of trying to share who Yahweh is and what he's offering. And the last thing we want to say is a permanent damaging rift between anyone in the family.
No, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, that's just absolutely true. And, you know, it was my mistake. I mean, I was working. I was in the middle of what it was, you'd put up burning my ears and this and that. What you were doing was quoting them. And I was going, you're what? Your ears are burning? What, are you kidding me?
No, no.
You know, a first grader? Put a dress on. You know, I mean, I'm the kind of guy that goes right after this stuff.
Yeah.
And it was stupid of me because I was reading it out of context. Of course, I wasn't careful. And it was Fred's wife that straightened me out, if you want to know the truth. She goes, no, wait a minute. That's not what was happening here. And I can be straightened out because guess what? I'm an idiot. I'm an idiot, and
sometimes
I need to be straightened out from
time
to time.
Yeah, sometimes
that's just
a
good the way it is.
A straight-up guy.
But I will never have anybody tell me that saying using the F-bomb means you need to be punished, and I'm going to teach you and all this childish nonsense. Because that's not what we are, and I don't have a leader. And to walk into our group and to talk about Larry, your leader, first of all, Larry's not a leader. I find this very, very condescending and second rate. I thought they came in there looking to become leaders, and they both got bounced out on their collective asses. That's all it was.
Yeah.
And that's what made them angry.
Yeah.
They wanted to lead.
Some, yeah, I bottom line here is that, I'm not going to say bottom line. I want to say one other thing about just the environment, which is why you, I think, jumped to conclusions. It is really difficult with electronic media. It's one of the real problems with society today, whether it be Facebook or texting or emails or Instagrams or whatever it may be. It is really difficult in electronic media where you do not have the face, you do not have the expression, you do not have the countenance, and you do not have the voice of the individual. You're reading words. You can't tell if they're being said in jest. You can't tell if they're being presented as as the projection of somebody else's argument. It's real. You can't even tell sometimes who they're coming from because
so
many comments.
Especially in these emails.
Oh, of course, it is so easy to miss. Understand what somebody is saying and to get into a drag out argument when nobody really meant any harm in the first place, that it was a case of mistaken identity. So we have to be careful because the media, while very powerful in terms of its outreach, is also susceptible to problems that we wouldn't otherwise have.
That is right.
And then the second thing is that, at the end of the of this chapter 7, which I'll send out tomorrow after I finish my first repass, or I finish the chapter, but I like to read it through one time before I send it out. I decided that I would tackle something that Roy had sent to me. And Roy had sent me two letters. One was on the nature of the trees in the garden, and the other one was on the Nesoma. And since the Nesoma came up in the last statement of Yashaya 2, and I had to go back to the garden to figure out what kind of Nesoma we were talking about there, I figured, this is the place. I might as well go ahead and try to incorporate Roy's two insights on these things into the chapter. And in so doing, wouldn't you know it, the two proverbs that explain the Tree of Life speak specifically about language and how we approach other people. And so it's there, and it's worth considering, and we will end up doing shows on them. I had never seen this stuff before. First time I translated it, and I thought it was interesting in terms of the language. And there are one of the most interesting things, and I didn't make much of a comment on this because I was trying to just present the information and let people make their own conclusion. But there's one place where Yahweh uses that word, and I've forgotten it right off, that it starts with a CH, can mean primary meaning is to respond, to make a declaration. The secondary meaning is to bow down in worship. And
yes.
He was, pardon?
I said, yeah, I know.
Yeah. So he was
the
using
primary
that
meaning
word.
Is to make a declaration, something I do
right,
all the
right.
time. I
right.
never
and
bow
so
down and worship.
He used that word, and he was talking about the arguments that we propose and their impact on people. And the whole thing was such that every word had two different meanings. And so you could interpret it as, you know, if you give a thoughtful answer to someone that is religious, yeah, they're going to get angry by it. And they're going to respond angrily. And you can also read it as if you give somebody an angered response who is thoughtful, that you're going to inspire them to anger. And so it's really interesting trying to go through this and say, what is God saying? Or unless is he really saying all of these things? But I think you'll find it interesting as to what he said. Anyway, I want to get back to Proverbs 7:14. So first, this is in God's voice. He may be saying, a reconciling sacrificial offering of fellowship was provided by me the day I fulfilled and completed my vows. Now, was a sacrificial
offering... That makes sense
offering, to me. Okay, was a sacrificial offering provided by Yahweh?
Yep.
Did he complete
yes.
his vows in a day?
Yes. Oh, yes, he did.
No.
Yep.
No, he did
no,
not.
No, he didn't.
No,
oh,
he did not.
He did.
Nope. Yeah, that was the problem that I had with it. No, he didn't. What's wrong with that?
Were provided by me the day I fulfilled and completed.
Ain't no matzah in this.
Yeah, man.
That's over. Wednesday.
Yeah, he did. He did make a sacrificial offering.
Ah.
Provided
yeah,
by him.
Yeah.
On
see, offering. I'm thinking of the three, Moed.
But did he fulfill that in a day? On the day?
No, that was two,
no,
that was two days.
That
was 2 days.
Most important day, he missed.
Betcha. So what religion? What religion focuses on the singular day that Yahweh made his
the same one that focuses on a wooden pole.
There
the same
you
one
go.
That focuses on a wooden pole
yeah,
to hide the truth
is,
so it didn't go any further.
Christianity on the
yeah.
day that I made my sacrifice.
Yeah, that's right.
That's how,
it's subtle,
that's how
that's
easy
right.
it is to miss.
Very subtle.
Yep.
Right. That? But it's not just subtle. It's life and death. It's everything.
Yeah.
Yes, but it's subtle. It's very
subtle. Of course, it's really subtle.
You know, they say the devil's in the details, but the opposite is true also. Yahweh's
yeah.
in the detail.
Yep.
Well,
yes,
you know,
Yahweh has made a reconciling sacrifice on our behalf for the relationship. However, there were two sacrifices over 7 days, Pesach and Matzah as the first of the 7 Mikre, not 1 day. The final
right, and in Habakkuk he says the same thing. He goes right to the wooden pillar stops them from seeing any further.
That is correct.
Yes,
all ties together,
same
doesn't it?
Thing.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah, I get it now. Yeah, I blew that, but you know it's easy enough
listen, I want to tell you so just to show you how fallible I am here. Because I don't want you hanging out there, Larry. I want you to be in good company when you're hanging out there and you blew it.
Yeah.
First time I went through these statements, I said, he's talking about the whore here. And I translated all of these things in the whore's voice. And then I said, who am I to do that? This is a proverb. And the proverb, it's Yahweh speaking in first person to his children. He's just returned to first person. I can't write this in the whore's voice. It's too close to the truth. And so I completely eliminated everything I had done, and I started all over again, and I wrote it all in Yahweh's voice. And then I sent it out to a couple of people, and said, oh, God, I'm really uncomfortable with this. And I sent it out, and Roy sent it, gave me a note, which and his note arrived at the same time that I had already pulled up the chapter and said, I got to rewrite this. And his note said, hey, Craig, there ain't no way. It can't be in Yahweh's voice. And so I was already about a third of the way through rewriting it. And I spent 2 days rewriting it. And then because I rewrote it all, I had tossed away it in Yahweh's voice. So I ended up having to go back and write it in Yahweh's voice just so I could show you why it's not in Yahweh's voice.
You know, when you get down there, and I know we're not quite there, but when you get to Proverbs 7:18, you know, he really describes this big love fest, which really does,
yeah,
you know, describe,
is.
describe the religion of Christianity. I mean, we're all out here alone. I mean, we're just out here alone. I mean, that's just the truth of it.
Yeah.
Most of us even do PSOC alone, you know?
Yeah, we do.
I mean, really.
We do. Yeah. That's why I want to tell you what it was this program and the communication that we have through the books is so important, because while it is I'm very content to spend my day listening to Yahweh and translating His word and learning from Him. It's really fun for me. I'm just really content to do that. There is something about being together as a family that is enriching. It's what makes it especially fun. So anyway, this first statement, it's so close, but it's closest to Christianity. It's the exact ploy that Satan pulled. Now, the next statement. For this reason, I went out, descended to serve, and extended myself to approach and to meet you, to extend an invitation to you, calling you out, to welcome you, earnestly seeking your presence. And I have located you. Now, Yahweh descended from heaven in the seventh dimension, extending Himself to serve us. That part's true. He invited us to join Him because He seeks our presence. However, the covenant is the reason that Yahweh descended to serve us, and it was not mentioned here. So in actuality, the fulfillment of His mikrei have served to make this relationship possible. However, this statement seems to suggest that His purpose was to approach us rather than enabling us to approach Him. And also, the sacrifice singular was somehow the purpose in and of itself. Further, the Torah's purpose is to help us find God, not the other way around. This says, "And I located you." That's not
how
it works.
That's not how it works at all.
No.
I located you. Yeah.
No.
That is the Christian idea, though, because He's omnipresent. He's everywhere. Yeah, sure.
And equally concerning, Yahweh has told us in very specific terms where He saw this man and with whom He was associating. And it was not with Him. All right. So then we have 7:16. And I have spread out beautiful fabrics on my couch, cutting the most elaborate and dark textiles of processed fibers of linen out of Egypt. Okay, when I was doing this one, what in
Egypt.
The hell?
Out of Egypt. Yeah, you're right.
Back to Islam or in the Quran and fabrics out of Egypt? No way. This reads like the Quran, for crying out loud. And that's where Roy sent me back and said, God is not taking His fabrics for couches in heaven from Mitzrayim.
No way. No, that's the place we're walking away from. You know, I mean.
Forget it. Correct. Forget it.
You're right. This is all in the enemy's voice. I mean, not a lot of people would have. I told you this before. Not a lot of people would have had the guts to do this. You understand that? I mean, they just wouldn't.
I didn't have the guts to stay with it. That's why I rewrote it. And then finally, I just said I couldn't live with myself. I said no. The one thing I found about Yahweh is He is consistent, He is perfect, He doesn't cut corners. There is no way this is from Him. He doesn't compromise. Can't be from Him.
Let me throw out two words for you real quick in this sentence you just read. First of all, where it says my couch or bed is translated Eris. That's also a sick bed.
Mm-hmm.
When I figured this is Satan, I put all the negative meanings down as well as the positive meanings.
Yeah, by the way, also the bed that you use as the litter that would carry somebody away who has died in battle. Not just a sick bed. It's a gurney that is used to carry a dead body.
And then you move down to the bedspread. And if you go to an early meaning on the bedspread is, I'm sorry, let me skip down to the linens. Etun is also is like Aton, And then that's a lattice that is used, or shutters that are used to shut up the window to block out the
shut out light.
That's not in context. That would not be in the context of what Yahweh would use. He's light to open and to enlighten us. So every one of those words that I was doing on this one and several of the others is just, that ain't Yahweh. That's why I told you, it can't be. So here we go, solid ground. It's not like you.
Well, when you're talking about Egypt and you're talking about one day, I mean, we got problems.
I have lightly dusted my bed. Yahweh, through Yosha, tells us that he's going to move over on his throne so we can sit right beside him. Co-regents, if you will, over the universe. But I don't know of any place where Yahweh says, I have a bed and you can lie down with me.
No, that's not.
That almost creeps me out.
Spirits don't have sex.
Yeah.
So that ain't happening. But...
Yeah, okay.
I'm here and there.
But I would go one more time. I can understand why when we're camping out, there might be some comfy sofas around. They're not going to have Egyptian fabric on it. But, personally, that's not the kind of furniture that I want to be sitting on as I'm around the old bonfire on the Shabbat as we're making s'mores. But let's just say I can go along with having some place comfy to sit as we're enjoying the bonfire. But a bed? What in hell would we have to do with a bed in heaven? Do you think we're going to get tired?
If you're made out of energy.
How in the world are you going to eat a bed in heaven? I'm sorry.
Our seventh day of rest ain't going to be rest. It's when we gather. It's when we get
course.
To talk about all the stuff we've done.
Of course.
Seventh day of freedom would be another way to put it, really. But,
Yeah. Okay, so the next one. I want you to choose to continually come and walk this way, actually living like this, for us to fully experience love's, this is Yodim, until the approach of the morning and for an eternity thereafter. Let us enjoy one another's company, reveling in the pleasure of love, of adoration and affection.
This is pillow talk.
Oh, my goodness.
It's definitely Christian.
I think my relationship with Yahweh is, hugely inferior to Dode's, similar to Dode's, in the sense of I come at it the same way. We're buds. I know I'm flawed. I get it. That he's infinitely superior to me, but I'm really comfortable around him. I just really am. I'm comfortable around him. I got no issue with saying, you're going to do all these things for me, and my flaws don't bother you in the least because that's what you've said. You're committed, God, to doing what you said, and so I don't have an issue pushing God's buttons in the sense of saying, I know that I don't have to worry about a Muslim jihadist coming to threaten me. I don't have to worry about it. You've already made your promise. It's a done deal. I'm really comfortable in our relationship. I don't put God on a pedestal. I don't tell him 10 times a day, I really love you. I know you love me. The Bible tells me so. Just don't do that. It's not real. It's just
a relationship. It's like somebody saying, if they walked up and they said, I praise you, Larry. I praise you.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even know what the hell that means. If somebody said to me, thanks for buying me dinner last night.
Yeah.
I'd understand what that meant. I'd say, you're welcome. No problem.
Yeah, no.
Let me give you an idea, Larry. When all this was going down, and one of the people I thought was trying to distance you and I from one another, I just wrote this back. I just said, Larry has always been, is, and will always be my friend. That's just the bottom line. Larry has always been, is, and always will be my friend. calling you my friend, I'm very comfortable with that. I wouldn't go so far to say I love you. You know,
Even as lovable as he is,
that's just because you don't know me. That's all.
You know, I mean, I really like Scott. I really like you, Kirk. I'm just not going to use the term love.
Right, I'm not.
And Kirk, I really like you, but I'm not going to use the term love. I'll use the term love as it relates to a man, but that man is my son. You know? But outside of my family.
No, I do know.
Yeah. And with Yahwa, my relationship with Yahwa is far more man to man than it is man to spirit in terms of the set apart spirit. It's just the way I relate. And so I don't use the term love. I use the term respect. I use the term, I think he's funny, that he's cool, that he's enjoyable to be around.
Well, he never even requires you to love him. He said, I want you to love my name, and he said, and I want you to respect me, as in you're
right. And I do.
But he never says, I want you to love me.
This love fest here, that we're just going to sit around and love one another.
Yeah, that's right. He never says that.
Right.
He never says it.
No, I just don't see that as, that's not the God I know. The God I know wants to go off and have fun. He wants to be sarcastic when it's appropriate. He wants to joke around when it's appropriate. He wants to screw around when it's improper. By screw around, I mean just do some things that are off the wall. Not everything with God is calculated. It really isn't. There are things that are calculated, but I think that the whole idea of a relationship is not calculated. You know, if Yahweh created us to be his robot and he programmed us to do what he wanted, do you know how long it would take for him to get tired of that?
10 seconds?
Yeah, if that. If that. So what that means is we aren't programmed. We're going to do stuff that's off the wall. And this idea of us just wallowing in love, I mean, first of all, why in the world would God love me? I can see why he'd be entertained. I can see why I can make him giggle. I can see why it might, you know, it'd be fun. But I'm really much more comfortable with the relationship terms that are real.
If you're shamaring Torah,
yeah,
you are studying his word and responding appropriately and learning, is there any way he could separate you from Yahweh? Anybody could separate you from Yahweh?
No, of course not. No.
Okay, so then everything else is academic.
Yeah.
I mean, you screw up.
Who cares? That's right. Who cares? I don't even know.
Yeah. He sees his light.
Now, you know, I understand that God's favorite person in the world, the name means beloved. You know, Dod means beloved. Now, you know, it's a kind of a special term, but it's used right here. It's, you know, love. You know, loves in the sense of dotem. And I would agree. God is lovable, and he is absolutely perfect.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing to see somebody's really lovable. It's another to say, I love you. And, you know, we had a person who had been, you know, really in the group for almost a year and a half. Didn't really contribute much, but Honor Page wrote this incredible diatribe about how with every breath I love you and I'm with you and you're with me always. And it sounded like, you know, it was her stab at a mizmor.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounded like a mizmor straight out of an English Bible. It was horrible. And I just took it apart and said, this isn't true. That isn't true. Are you so important he's really with you all the time? I said, you know, he's not omnipresent, so how can this possibly be unless you're overly important? And, you know, I just went through this whole thing with her and finally said, you know, you're really going to have to leave the group because in a year and a half you haven't learned anything but other than how to be religious and use his name at the same time, which is really sad.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that's interesting here is that there is the phrase ad ha bokor. Ad ha bokor. I have trying my best to put this in Yahweh's voice. I translated until the approach of morning and for an eternity thereafter, because ad can mean eternity. But if you're going to accurately translate the phrase ad ha bokor, it's until the morning. So tomorrow that morning, means then that until the morning, let us enjoy one another's company, reveling in the pleasures of love. That's like a prostitute. Yeah, hey, man, sure. I'll spend the night with you. Doesn't it? I mean, it's a prostitute. It's until the morning.
Yeah, giving it
dawn. Exactly like a whore. Do you think that God is going to tell you, hey, you know, I'm going to engage in this relationship. I'm going to make you part of my family until morning.
Mm-hmm. And I'm moving on.
The next day, man, I'm moving on, and you're on your own. Can you imagine marrying somebody that says, I'll love you until the morning?
Well, don't they have those kind of marriages in Islam?
Yes, they do.
Oh.
It ain't love.
Number four.
Okay.
You know what that's called? It's called temporary wife. That's called temporary wife.
It's called sleep with a really hot slave, just that you got to claim it as a marriage so you can get...
Yeah, prostitute.
Well, you got to go to the cleric to get the piece of paper signed, and you have to pay him, by the way.
Of course. Like rabbinical Judaism, is always a cost involved. However, it is... However, it is for naught, because man, he has walked on a path that is far away and is now estranged. So if indeed this is the God's voice, it would be true. Most have turned him down. Yahweh most always affirms that his covenant family in heaven lives in his home, but not here. His is addressing the wayward man, not God. So while his home becomes our home once we are part of his family, this estranged man is clearly on a path that is leading away from the covenant. However, it is not, it is for naught, because the man isn't in his home. Well, if God was speaking, he wouldn't use his, it would be my home.
Mm-hmm.
It is for naught because the man isn't in my home. He didn't say that. It says, however, it is for naught because the man is in his home.
This is clearly written in the enemy's voice, and you know, I've done that before when I'm talking. I've done that.
Yeah.
I get that. I totally get
that. You do it all the time. Yeah, when you're funny advertisements for religion. And but you know what? Again, just think of how subtle that is. It's a pronoun that is twisted. It's just like a counterfeit bill. You change one line and it becomes worthless. It's a liability.
Right.
You change one pronoun from my to his, and it goes from being true to being false.
Is it significant? I looked up Ish again, which I would never normally look up at this stage, but it's, you know, besides man, husband, man, one. It also has adultery, but it also has Benjamite three times.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
They didn't have another tribe. It just said Benjamin three times.
Yeah,
negative connotations, correct?
Yeah, and you know, one of the problems that I've had, because I see a lot of that, where the words that come up and the lexicons will cite Benjamin, and they typically cite Benjamin because the word is the name of someone associated with the tribe of Benjamin. And I typically don't play off of it because, you know, there are so many profound, right in your face, the Benjamite is the plague of death, that these are really subtle and they take a lot of tracking down to. But that's the reason that they list the lexicons, put Benjamin or Benjamite in association with some of these words, is that there was an individual from the tribe of Benjamin with that name, or there was a town in the territory of Benjamin that carried that name.
Okay, fair enough.
That's the reason it's there. So there is a legitimate connection. It's just that it's, you're really chasing
it. Write them all down anyway, so.
Yeah, no, it's a good thing to do. I started to include them and then took them out, and I'm just sharing it. So it's not wrong to include them. I took them out because sometimes if you if you have to really work to make a point and the point is,
don't do it.
Is not a strong one and it takes a lot of effort to make it, then sometimes you're counterproductive by leading people away from the stuff that is profound and right in your face.
Sure.
And this is already
well,
a pretty
because
tough argument.
People who want to challenge you are going to automatically go to your weakest arguments and they're going to dwell on
the we're going to get a call real quick here on the next word at Halak and Halak, rather.
Yeah.
So a long journey, so he's more profound there. So I agree.
Yep. Now, if this segment of the story is being told in the whore's voice, it is incumbent upon us to render each word so that, to the greatest degree possible, it reflects the Christian perspective, revealing how the whore uses religion to fool the foolish into worshiping Satan as the Lord God. Keeping in mind that the Hebrew language was created to present a choice between good and evil, that's why that tree exists, and thereby convey the consequence of our choices. So while everything I've presented previously is supported by the most reputable Hebrew lexicons, and Kirk, you verified that, and dictionaries, what follows is also justifiable when rendered from an entirely different perspective. It's just like ana can mean afflict, but its primary meaning is to answer and respond. Yare can mean fear, but its primary meaning is to respect. There's a lot of words in Hebrew like that. All right. The sacrifice of being killed as a peace offering to finish and fulfill the promise of fellowship were provided by me, the Almighty, the one day I fulfilled and completed and therefore finished once and for all my vows.
That's cool.
They're in Christianity. I died for you.
Oh, that's nothing Christianity.
Right. Nothing happened on matzah.
Right.
Nothing happened on Bukurim. Nothing happened on Shabuah. Nothing. The rest of this stuff is a waste of time. I died for you. The sacrifice of being killed as a peace offering to finish and fulfill the promise of fellowship was provided by me, the Almighty. The day I fulfilled and completed and therefore finished once and for all my vows. That's it. Therein is Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
This is the dark and deadly soul of Christianity. The religion's God died, sacrificing himself on Good Friday as he completed in one day, not only fulfilling the sum total of God's promises, but in so doing, ending the purpose of his prior testimony. There'd be no mention of Passover, of the Lamb, of the doorway to life, or what followed over the next 2 days, unyeasted bread, and firstborn children. It would lead all Christians issuing nedar vows, pledging that they believe that their God actually died and that his death resolved their sin. And lest I forget, the primary definition of all as a preposition is over, and as a noun is almighty. And this is a summation of Satan's ambition to be seen as Al, over and above the Most High. It is the raison d'etre of the most popular religion in human history. For this reason, I came out to bring forth, to approach and meet you, calling out to you, longing to darken your presence, and I have found you, attaining control over you, possessing you.
Darken your presence is kind of a scary thought when you're thinking in terms of Yahweh. Yeah.
Yep. In every pagan religion, the Son of God dies in the spring to resurrect life. This is the reason Satan came in the guise of the Babylonian Tammuz, the Egyptian Osiris, the Greek Dionysus, the Roman Bacchus, the Druid Jesus. In so doing, the whore of religion would darken men's souls, precluding them from seeing the light. While Satan has been deprived in this way, destined into the darkness of Sheol, the devil would use Shaul to take countless others with him. If misery loves company, they would have their party. And while Satan has found many, attaining control over them with his religions, He only possesses those he inspires to create and convey these religions. But such was the case with Paul. Every time "you" has been used in this proverb, it has been singular and masculine. You know, in English, we can say "you," and you don't know if I'm talking singular, plural, masculine, and feminine. We know it here. "For this reason, I came out to bring forth, to approach and meet with you," masculine, singular. "Calling out to you," masculine, singular. "Longing to darken your presence," masculine, singular. "And I have found you," masculine, singular. "Attaining control over you," possessing you, masculine, singular. It's a lot different when you actually convey the gender, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's very direct. I mean, we're talking about a single, obviously young man with real poor judgment skills. Yep.
Yeah, real poor. Boy, ain't that the truth. "I have blanketed covers on my bed, cutting dark-hued and elaborate fabrics of processed and ghostly fibers to bind out of the crucibles of human religious oppression." Now, there is Etun Mitzrayim with the words rendered with their primary definitions. "And I have blanketed," that's rabad, "I have placed over, lowering the object beneath, covers, spreads, which cover up and cover over, on my bed, my couch, my reclining furniture, and my death fire, cutting dark-hued and elaborate fabrics, chatuboth, gathering vivid cloth, and applying fine needlework and embroidery, of processed and ghostly fibers to bind, of fine threads and linens from an unused root meaning to bind, akin to et, and in the plural etim, necromancers and ghosts of the dead and disembodied, of the occult sorcerers and their idols, and etim, shutting the door and causing them to ignore, to forget, and not to respond." So this is he wove into this fabric sorcerers, idolatry, ghosts, the occult. Yeah, it's not of God, is it? And all
no,
where that came from was from the crucibles of human oppression, Mitzrayim. Pauline doctrine covers over the truth, blanketing the Torah in a dark and elaborate cloth embroidered with the self-proclaimed apostles' musings. Christianity is woven out of the binding religious fibers Paul possessed on behalf of the occult to shut Passover's door to life and to cause billions to ignore the Torah. The bed he made for believers was decorated in all of the trappings of Egypt, leading the faithful back into religious slavery.
Right down to Amun Ra, the end of all their religious veneration.
Every single one. In the name of God, we pray. Amen. Yep, there you go. "I have besprinkled my bed. I have cast a small amount as perfume on my bed, my death buyer, my stretcher to carry a corpse, with myrrh, a fragrant yet bitter extract from the bark of an Arabian gum, the symbol of Islam, seen as a sacred religious oil, rendered gall, a lesion or wound, an irritating blister or sore. Aloes, which is an aromatic byproduct of decaying wood, often used to fumigate and thus kill, from India, which is perhaps symbolic of Hinduism. From ahal, to shine, which is what Satan does, and cinnamon, cinnamon, dried powder from the inner bark of the cinnamon tree. I borrowed wood from the Chinese, perhaps a metaphor for Confucianism and Buddhism. The bed Paul made for Christians would be a deathbed, an aromatic product of decay, designed to carry a corpse. And his method of sprinkling, it became baptism. The Christian rite, designed to replace circumcision. Boy, there's a lot there, isn't there?
I have some mediocre ones, but that was so much better. Never mind.
I want you to choose to continually walk this way, living like this, for us to fully experience being lovers.
Beg your pardon?
Until morning. Yeah, being lovers. Lovers engaged.
Well, you know what's wild? Yahweh never tells us how to live. Not really.
No.
No, he doesn't.
Does he ever tell us to be lovers? Does he ever tell us, I'm creating a bed. I want you to lie down with me in that bed, and we're going to be lovers. Doesn't Yahweh project himself as male?
Yes.
I'm a male.
I'd find this odd.
Is it appropriate for two men to lie down together?
Nope.
It isn't.
Even if I was a woman, that's still just a bit creepy.
That's creepy. Yeah, it's creepy. Even if we're dealing with the set-apart spirit, I don't want to climb in bed with the set-apart spirit. I am delighted with the set-apart spirit's counsel, wisdom, insights, support, nurture, garment of light, which is the Torah. Got to, you know, total and complete respect. But my engagement with the set-apart spirit is when I'm sitting here translating and sharing insights from Yah's word. I do not have a relationship with the set apart spirit when I lie down in my bed at night. I'm just going to tell you, it doesn't work that way. That's what this is saying. We're going to be lovers. We're going to be lovers till morning. Yeah, we're going to be until morning. Let's be lovers, enjoying one another's company, reveling in the pleasures of lovemaking.
Until morning, and what happens after morning?
I'm going to take your money, and I'm going to walk away. I'm going to find another stooge that I can tell wonderful things to that will believe that, oh, you are such a great lover. Okay. This is the whore. And it's so obvious that it's the whore. Now, there it is. However, as we move to the next statement, the narrator is no longer speaking in first person. Yet, since this is the consequence of succumbing to the allure of religion, it remains true no matter how we interpret the preceding story. It is all for naught. The whore of religion is not a reliable, dependable lover. Having ruined one life, she moves on to the next. However, it is for naught because the man isn't in his home. He has walked on a path that is far away and is now estranged. If you, Larry, decided today that you wanted to sleep with a whore, are you going to bring the whore into your house? Are you going to go find a place that you're going to have to leave your wife and family to go and engage with this whore?
Well, I'm not doing that, but if I were,
I haven't given a lot of thought to that. What have you there, Larry?
Yeah,
I really
not your question, JB. Yeah, is it? Because it's just, it's not.
If you found
the prettiest whore on the planet and you paid for said whore, I don't know if you ever watched the Big Bang Theory, but one of the programs is that Raj figures out that this woman at the bar that is coming onto them is a prostitute, and then the two guys, because Howard is having a bad day, they set up this Jewish woman to be a prostitute, and they pay for the experience for Howard and design it to have her give not only the girlfriend experience but the experience. Jewish girlfriend experience. And you know, Howard's just excited that somebody else has paid for and arranged this prostitute to be his companion and give him the Jewish girlfriend experience. I'm going to tell you that I wouldn't succumb. Even if you guys all passed around a collection plate and had the prettiest girl just show up here one day and say, you know, I'm I'm here. The guys chipped in and paid for it. So we're all in the same boat there. But beyond that, the issue here is, and this is the message, is that those who engage with a prostitute, the whore is a prostitute, they leave their home to do so. So now that person is not only estranged from their family, they're also estranged from the whore because the whore got up and left them in the morning, but they had to leave their family, and so they're now all alone.
There's another insight here. Can I just throw it out there? And I know you know this insight. That Benjamin.
Yeah.
He moves towards the sea of who? The Goyim.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, there
right.
it is.
He
right
left
there.
That's right. He left his own Paul. Left. Not only does the Benjamite, the tribe, leave Yehudah and rail against Yehudah, and moves to the sea of the Goyim. But think about Paul. Paul left Yehudim and went to the Gentiles to make his bed with the Gentiles, and guess what? They all rejected him.
Went all the way to Rome.
Yeah, all the way to Rome. And he writes Timothy in Rome, everyone has rejected me.
Well, at least the Romans had some sense.
And, you know, it's very funny, too, because you get the messianics that don't want to let go of Paulos. And
yeah.
they say you really have to have the Jewish mindset to understand him. And it's like, wow, you know, these were all, you know, what you'd call Yehuda. They hadn't distanced themselves by calling themselves Jews at that point.
Yeah, no,
they were Yehuda.
Yeah, what's interesting, of course, is that if Paul is assailing the Torah, which he is, and that's obvious, then there's no way that a Jewish mindset is going to salvage that. If he was
like castration,
right? Now there's a lot of messianics that claim, yeah, I castrate anyone that's Torah observant. There's a lot of messianics that claim that he's assailing the Talmud and not the Torah. But then, if he's assailing the Talmud, how could you have a Jewish mindset and appreciate Paul if he's assailing the cornerstone of your religion?
Yeah.
But if you have to have a Jewish mindset to understand Paul, how come he only went to Gentiles?
Yeah, that's
good point.
Why did Yael Conan end up writing to all the Gentile assemblies? You know, I mean, why didn't he pick Paulos? I mean, there's a lot
of... I really don't think that people in Corinth or Galatia or Thessalonica, all those, you know, Greek and Roman provinces, I don't think any of them had Jewish mindsets. They were all boys.
As a matter of fact, what Paul says in all of his letters is that it's the Jewish mindset that he railed against. He called them Judaizers.
Yeah, I did.
And so if you had a Jewish mindset, you were Paul's mortal enemy. I mean, how do people with a straight face say such rubbish? I mean, it's just...
They just cannot let go of religion. I mean, look, I actually had a guy who's reading Yada Yada and ITG, and he keeps wanting me to ask you questions. I just keep answering him, you know, out of ITG and Yada Yada notes I have. But there's a fellow who was a professor of religious studies. Get this.
Mm-hmm.
Professor of religious studies. Speaking of saying things with a straight face.
Right.
I just want to read this real quick. Please study this out carefully. First of all, Yahweh is a misunderstanding of how the Hebrew Bible, I didn't know there was a Hebrew Bible, presents the name of God. Frankly, we don't know how to pronounce the name, and he's got in modern Hebrew.
Oh, you're an idiot.
Now listen to this. But it's not Yahweh or Jehovah. Both these are misguided attempts to read consonants, Yad-He, Wah-He, which... with the vowels of Adonai. No kidding. Which the rabbis used to vocalize the consonants. Only a lack of understanding of what the rabbis were attempting to do. Listen, they would see these vowels as Adonai. So to pronounce God's name in vain They would never put them together. Now, what I asked him was, well,
by the way,
you
that,
know,
that
how would you pronounce
argument, that line of argument has been
how would you pronounce
Yasha
Yahu? I said Rumpelstiltskin. Yeah. I mean, really? I mean, it makes as much sense. Yasha Yahu would translate.
The most convoluted piece of junk I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But by the way, that argument, he did not come up with that argument. I saw that argument 20 years ago, and that Adonai was written above Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh for the express purpose of providing the vocalization of the name, and that's how they got Jehovah. And so that argument's been around for a long time. But everything the man said is not only untrue, it's irrational.
Oh, sure.
And it's irrational to say that you cannot pronounce Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh because the letters are among the 22 Hebrew letters, and that every word that they're in and every name they're in is pronounceable. So to say that that these common letters among the 22 in Hebrew are not pronounceable when every other letter is pronounceable is just stupid beyond comprehension. Also, to say that they are consonants is directly inconsistent with A, the way they are pronounced in every Hebrew word, because they're always pronounced with an open mouth sound, which is a vowel. But beyond that, you know, even Josephus, when he was saying the four letters that comprise Yahweh's name, what did he call them? Four consonants or four vowels?
Four vowels.
Right.
I don't know enough Hebrew to carry on a conversation with a three-year-old, but I do know enough words, and I can look at the words and see how the letters are pronounced,
right,
and easily
right.
come up with how to pronounce Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh.
Well, you know, I did spend several days because I didn't want to just look at the most common words like Shalom and Eloah and Goyim and Torah. And hi-yah to come
and
up
L-O-I.
With
these.
All right,
I looked
good.
At every single word in the entire Hebrew lexicon. I looked at every single. I took days. I just said, I'm going to be thorough. I'm going to do this once. I went and what I came up with is the hey is pronounced as ah.
Yeah.
In the
range of 99%
of the time. So the hey is pronounced ah 98 to 99% of the time, and it's 99.9% of the time when it's the end of a word or a name.
Yes.
The hey. And that every important Hebrew word that has the hey in it, like Torah, it is pronounced ah without exception. The second thing I found is that there is no circumstance where the Hebrew Y is any different than the English Y, and therefore it's a consonant vowel. In English, you look up the Y and you look up the W in English, and both are registered as consonant vowels. And they're exactly the same. Why do you think we came up with the name W?
Yes, 2 years.
Right. You know, if you look at, even look at how Hebrew influenced English, and you look at the Hebrew, the English words with a W in them, and almost just an overwhelming percentage of them are like owl or oath or own.
Or howl.
Or howl. Mm-hmm. How do you think we came up with all this stuff? And so, but then when you look at the, so, The yod is straightforward. I mean, there is a 0% chance that the yod is anything other than a consonant vowel, just like it is in English, and it's pronounced as the Y is in the English word yes. There was no doubt whatsoever. And hey was 99.9% certain. Only left you with one letter. And that letter, you have a choice. It's either the U sound or the O sound. And so if you look up the number of times that that the wah is used in Hebrew, it's about 80% of the time it is pronounced O, and about 20% of the time it is pronounced U.
Ooh.
So 80-20. Then if you look at
well, it's not only that.
Hebrew words,
the O
like Torah
is the basis
Shalom,
for light.
And and Elohim from Eloah, 100% of the most important and common Hebrew words, 100% of the time, and the most common words is pronounced as an O. But the one that clinched it for me was all of the names like Yoel and Yob, and there are about 50 of them, which are contractions of Yahweh and some other word, like Yoel, Yahweh is God, El, that in the contractions of Yahweh's name, like Yob and Yoel, it's the O sound that is kept. It's not Yub.
Yeah.
It's not Yuel. And so...
Judah.
Right.
One of the things I
really, really, really clear as to
yeah, it's the contracted names that make it an O, and beyond that, I mean, you got two options. You know, Yahweh was telling Abram to walk out of where Ur, and walk
right.
towards Him, which is light, which is O. I mean,
right.
Take your pick. I mean, use your mind.
Right.
You know.
Right. Right. Yeah, or is
Well,
I don't believe that.
Is.
I don't think.
Yeah,
there might be a 20% chance on paper, but not out of meaning because.
But not.
I know where I'm going to stake my.
I think Torah, Eloah, and Shalom,
and
Yoel and Yob. I think that those words. Make it less than a 1% likelihood.
Yeah.
Now,
and
you know,
was Yahweh trying to hide
his
name and make it a secret?
I'm still willing to say if somebody wants to use Yahuwah, well, I think there's less than a 1% chance that that's right. I'm just not going to fight with them. I'm just going to say, you know, I came to another conclusion based upon all of this evidence. I would invite you to do the same, but I am not going to part company with somebody over that because there is a fraction of a 1% chance that that we could be wrong here.
Well, you know, you're right about that, and I don't part company over that. But you know what I've found almost exclusively with people that don't know Yahweh's character, they use the U. I'm telling you, I've been in a thousand debates with them. They use the U every time.
Yeah.
Because they don't.
I use Yahuda for I know it's not Yahuda, it's Yahuda. And it's just what it is. You know, lots of places where the U is conveyed that I don't think ever was a U.
And I agree with that. I always thought it was Yahudi, not Yahudi.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
you know, Yahudi. You're going to get Yahudi today. That's what you're going to get. If you say Yahudi, they're going to think you're crazy.
Right.
I know.
Right.
I know.
I'm not extremely dogmatic on this because, you know, literally probably for the first 4 or 5 years where I was coming to know Yah, I called him Yahweh. Because, based on my research, what I knew and I understood, I thought that was his name. I've come to know more, I've learned more, and I've realized it. But so if someone's wanting to call him Yahweh or Yahuwah, I'm not going to dismiss him.
I will not dismiss somebody over Yahweh. I'll take the time to explain how I came up with Yahweh, and I'll use Yahweh. I think, you know, at least that is a major step in the right direction.
Lose the Yah, we're done. I'm done with it.
Yahweh is an honest attempt to put God's name back into his testimony.
Yeah.
And so I am not going to condemn the individual who is doing that. The third statement he etched in stone is it's unforgivable to render his name for naught, to eliminate his name to my Lord or Adonai or Lord God. That is making his name for naught. And that is an unforgivable sin. So you can't help that. Can't fix that. But somebody who's come to Yahweh, I want to tell you that the God I know, he's not bothered by that.
No.
It really isn't.
Now, there are a lot of people who use Yahweh who don't know him. But,
correct. There are.
Yeah, like I said, to me, that's not a divided line. I'm not saying I'm kicking you out because of that. You know, at least you're
I will tell you something that I have noticed here. And I came to notice it, James, as I was searching for, I wanted to find, you know, The last time I did a major search is I was trying to see if I could justify the claim that I had parroted from Ken that something happened in 133, which is the poisoning of the waters under the temple and fulfillment of number
1033.
Yeah, 1033. I couldn't find it. I just couldn't. I mean, I found one really weak reference that wasn't documented in any way, and so I just said, you know, just not enough substance here. But as I was doing the search and I was trying to fine-tune the search, what I found is there's now hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of websites where people are using the name Yahuwah. Now, if you were to go back 15 years ago, you wouldn't find one.
You wouldn't have found it at all. No, you wouldn't.
Nope. And the other thing I found is that terms like Mikre and terms like that really only began to appear as we were trying to flesh out Yahweh's testimony and conveying the words that were important to him, that they now have become part of a international discussion.
I'm in pleasure.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's awesome. I mean,
well, it's a beautiful thing. I mean, it's obviously
the
reading real material.
I found my translations all over in hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of sites as I was searching for this answer. People I didn't even know. And I was just, okay.
You'd be surprised how many people have tried to disparage me by saying you're using Craig Wynn's translations. And I'm thinking, you know, I say to them,
okay, so
you're going to attack me for using the most accurate translations that there are that I know of. And yet you're going to say, here's my answer, Psalm 45. Well, translate it for
Psalm
me. I mean, you can't just throw up something like that to me. I got to see what it says. And let's go over it and let's find out where Craig's wrong. How about that? Me and Jackie had that discussion this week. Just let's show me where he's wrong.
Right.
I mean, just
there, by the way, there's times that I've been wrong and people have
sure.
JB has brought up things where I was wrong. Now, I will tell you that when JB was doing a lot of translation, that and you would say, I don't know how you got here, and this is not what I'm getting, and we'd go through it and find out that you know, that what I was saying was defendable and was likely accurate. It's just that you really have to scratch and
well below the surface.
Yeah, well below the surface to find it. But that it was the most accurate and likely definition. But, you know, one of the things that I would say in your defense, not that you need defending, Larry, is that I have I've done something here recently where I went from doing a radio show 5 days a week and twice on Friday to stopping it so that I could spend time writing and translating. And when I did that move, there's something I stopped doing. I don't answer most of my emails. 90% of my emails I do not answer. And the reason I don't answer them is I can do one thing okay. If I try to do the two, I'm not very good at it. I get distracted. And so, Larry, your thing is to engage people, to reach out to them, to support the family, and to reach out against people who are religious in hopes that one person out of every, you know, 10 arguments might be open-minded enough, not the person you're arguing with, but somebody who reads it, would be intrigued enough to come to know Yahuwah. And that's where you spend the free time. That's where you spend your free time.
That's right.
You can't be good at that and do that and be also spending your time translating. You just can't.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean,
I've never claimed to be either.
Right.
But I do seriously consider translating.
But, you know, how many times do you see me out on a social network site engaging people?
I don't. You don't do that.
I don't.
That's not your bailiwick.
I can't translate and write and be doing that.
That's right. I know that.
So it's like saying, okay, but your translations are being used by Larry. Good. You know, everything that you do on these radio programs is being categorized and posted by Richard. Good. I don't have the time to do that. I can't do that.
That's why we do it.
If Richard's doing it. Right.
Yeah, hey, but that's, I mean, that's why it's done. That's why Richard does what he does. That's why I
right.
do what I do. I just,
right.
for the life of me, if somebody's going to attack, let's say somebody who attacks your translation, you know, I don't know.
Which I have
no
problem
example.
With. I got no problem
okay,
with
great.
That.
Great. But why don't you correct it? Don't just throw up, is this all you ever read, Psalm 119? Why don't you try Psalm 45? And, you know, Psalm 45, first of all, if you're calling it a psalm and not even calling it a mizmor, I already know you're using English translations. So what are you, where are you coming
right.
from? And let's see right. this translation. What, am I supposed to pick up a Bible and try
yeah.
to read it? I'm not going to read anything out of a Bible.
Yeah, and you know, by the
we're
way,
told
the
not
numbers,
to do that.
Even citing the numbers, if you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, what we use as numbers right now, is,
they're not even in it.
Hugely different than the order they appeared. You know, the 119th was around 90 something, and it was at the very end. It was the last of them. There was like this enormous expensive production of parchment, and then after the end of what we call the 119th, nothing. Which means that you know for certain it was the last of them. There was not a let's just say that the 119th psalm was 99. That means there wasn't 100. It was the last of them. It's the concluding of the psalms. And so when you cite a number, you're not citing anything that means anything to anybody, other than it will tell you at least where to look. But then, gosh, like in these proverbs. The difference between what the words actually say and what you find in English translation is so radical. And so I would agree with you, Larry. My view is that, yeah, you feel free to criticize my translations. And by the way, if you can approve them, great. That would be wonderful. But if you're going to criticize them, then come up with a more accurate translation. Demonstrate why mine is wrong and why yours is right.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's my point. You know, when somebody comes in and they, you know, we're word people at this point. You know,
here
I mean, you've got to show us that the word's there, what the root of the word means. I mean, you know, we're going to do some examining. You don't just throw up, hey, Isaiah 15:32, and run down the street like I'm going to even bother to look it up.
No, I want to say that you say something as part of this program. There's a lot of really smart people that are going to look it up and think it through. Like I mentioned that there was a particular term for mountain or hill, actually for hill, that was used 7 times in our last program. And I got an email saying, no, that word for hill appears over 100 times, and here's the 100 times that it appears. And a very subtle difference. But, you know, you better be really careful because the people listening to this program are thoughtful. And what I actually wrote was a little different than what I said. What I wrote was more precise. The word for hill was used exactly 7 times to depict a specific hill. While the word is used a bunch of times generically, it is only used 7 times to actually depict a specific hill. And so the point is that the audience for this program are very thoughtful people because you only get to know Yah and become part of the covenant by being thoughtful. And so you need to know what you say is going to be checked up on. You know, I wrote that
the Throne of God
the summit of Mount Moriah, where Abraham and Yahweh met. Where Yosha's body spent a little bit of Friday afternoon before it was destroyed, and where beneath which is the Ark of the Covenant. And I said that the summit of that mountain is 777 meters. And a meter is important because it's the length of a human stride, so it's exactly 777 strides above mean sea level, above the sea. And a bunch of people went to try to find topographical maps, which are unbelievably difficult for Jerusalem. And the consensus was that, you know, yeah, it could well be 777, but it might also be 776. You know. Okay. But I'm going to tell you, that's how precise and how eager people are to verify. I think it's great. I mean, I was laughing, but I'm not laughing. I thought that effort was marvelous. Like, I tried to find credible elevations and topographical maps for Jerusalem. And everything related to Jerusalem is grayed out. Even Google Maps, which normal, you know, I can bring a Google map of my home here in Ohio, and it will show, I mean, it'll show a leaf on a piece of ground cover. I mean, it's so detailed. But you get above Jerusalem, and you get down to even four clicks above the finest resolution, and everything grays out.
Why is that?
Well, I think there's lots of reasons for it, but that is the nature of things.
Well, obviously, and, yeah. When I get
and topographical maps for Jerusalem are few and far between. They're hard to find. I mean, I probably spent a day trying to verify these elevations and but it is, by the way, it's 777 strides from the set apart, the Holy of Holies, in the Second Temple where the covenant stood to where the covenant is right now, 777 strides. And the top of Mount Moriah, where Abraham and Yahweh met, is exactly 777 strides above the sea. So, I'm telling you, that's pretty extraordinary stuff. Horizontal and vertical.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Three sevens. And by the way, there are three Zions, and none of them is Mount Zion. You know, the Mount Zion, which is the western ridge of Jerusalem, just before it plummets down to the sea, across from the Central Valley, the Tyrolean Valley, the Central Valley. That is not Mount Zion. Mount Zion and the city of Dod are coterminous. Zion, it's actually not Mount Zion, it's just Zion, is coterminous with the city of David, according to Yahweh. Zion is coterminous with the highest summit of that mountain where the city of Dod is. The city of Dod is the lower part of the ridge of Moriah, directly below the Temple Mount, which is the middle ridge of Moriah. But the summit of Moriah is still uninhabited, unmolested. There's nothing built there. And so there are three signposts, three Zion on Moriah. City of Dod, the Temple Mount, and the summit of the mountain. Fairly profound stuff. All right, fellas.
Well, I had a Zionist write a post that I read, and she's very wealthy. She actually had called me a couple of times from Israel, wanted me to work with a group of hers. And I saw one of her posts, and it says, "You cannot be a true Zionist unless you're Jewish. You cannot be a true Zionist unless at Pesach you pray." Pesach, of course, is how she would say it. Pray towards Zion. And I thought, well, in Yahweh's eyes, yeah, I mean, she's into Judaism, of course. And I thought, well, in Yahweh's eyes, you're not a Zionist. Not really. Not at all.
No, a Zion is a signpost along the way.
Along the way.
It is a sign that is posted along the way from man's world to God's world. That's why the city of Dod is Zion. It's why the Temple Mount is Zion. It's why the place where the covenant was confirmed and the covenant, Ark of the Covenant now stands, is Zion. There's signposts along
but
the way.
Can you imagine that nonsense? Talk about driving people away.
Course.
I mean,
yeah,
how
the,
rude.
The world is becoming hugely anti-Zionist. That's, they don't want to become, they don't want to be seen as anti-Semites, so they always condemn Zionists.
Zionists.
And they have no
idea.
Yeah,
and then they make statements like that. To make statements like that just plays right into the hands.
It
and
does.
I mean, it's just,
it does.
It's just
yeah,
stupid.
It does, yeah.
Yep.
You know, there's a lot when you're reading Yashayah, and Yahweh rebuilds his, or actually not rebuilds, but he creates his house for his family on the highest summit of his mountains, which is the ultimate signpost. the people that he says go there with that are enriched with and empowered with exuberance on their faces are Goyim. Goyim. We're coming from around the world. So I want to tell you, that means that Goyim are Zionists.
That's exactly right. And I mean, when I read stuff like this, I thought, well, you know, here's a person that clearly doesn't even know Yahweh. I mean, they don't know Yahweh.
Yeah.
And since she doesn't know Yahweh, what is she doing making these?
Right.
Posts?
And by the way, is Zion spelled with a Z?
No, it's TS.
Yeah.
No.
It's TS. Yeah. And the TS is the signpost. You know, it's depicted as a person resting. So it's depicted as the person Shabbating, if you will. Sukkah. Yeah, the person camping out on Sukkah. But any time you see the TS, which you have, that's a sign. It's a signature. It's Yahweh's symbol. So signpost along the way. Zion. TS.
Well, I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong.
By the way,
is it
Zion?
No.
No.
And is Zion one of the most commonly pronounced Hebrew words?
That was Shalom, really big.
Yeah, wouldn't you put it in the top 20?
I would.
Yes, I would.
Yeah,
I
top
would.
20? Is it Zion?
No.
Where do we get the O in Zion?
Back to...
It's TS.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. TS what? Y, W, N, T, S,
yep.
Y, W, N.
It's a wah.
Mm-hmm. But since we don't know how to pronounce the yod wah. Or the or the wah.
It's unbelievably stupid.
But the yod and the wah are both in Zion. It's T, S, Y. So the T, S is the first letter, the Tazdei. Why the Yod?
And
the Nun.
Yeah, I know. I've seen it. It's
a sign from the hand of God, T.S. the Y, that empowers, enriches, adds to, shelters, and protects the Nun, which is the child born with an inheritance.
Yeah, well, it's astounding that somebody could even come up with that stupid thing. That's why I had to read it. Now, this is your professor, a professor.
Yeah, but how could it not be Zion if the Y is pronounced U?
Like a U, you mean? Yeah,
Zion. I am a Zionist.
Well, it's as though that there are people out there. See, what they've done is they've looked at Yehudi. They've looked at Yehudi.
I follow the Turei. It's got to be Turei because we don't want to have the H has got to be the E, so it's got to be the Turei.
Very good.
Shalom. I it's Barney Rubble speak again, and you know that's what it is. I know that's what it is. You know that's what it is, and I have to laugh at most of it, and it's become sad because I do realize that there are people that are misled by people all the time. But you know what? I'm going to tell you. Talk about signposts. When I'm talking to somebody and I just meet them and they spell Yahweh with an O, I know I'm talking to a serious player here. I do.
Oh yeah, I that's exactly my view. In closing, I want to say one thing. This is what I expected, but it still needs to be said. You went through a rough week. There was a lot of people you thought were piling on. Most were actually in your corner. But you know, you got yourself in a pickle, kind of reacting a little too hotly. And 99.9% of people, Larry, would have just walked away, said, I don't need this grief, and walked away. You didn't. You owned up to it. You participated. You contributed in a powerful way. It's exactly what I expected from you. It's why you're my friend.
Well, I appreciate that, and I when I saw the way that was Richard had posted it in such a way and unpopular that, and it just looked like JB had said all these awful things, and he was doing was quoting this person that was doing the attacking. And by the way, that lovely person doing the attacking, she really was set me up as a leader in unpopular, which I'm not a leader.
I don't want to go back into that other than to say that's what character does. You know, sometimes we all goof and you just own it.
I made a mistake. That was it.
You step right back into it one of the, you know, I use the term a man's man, somebody with character, with backbone. You know, that's the kind of people I like. So I am happy and proud to say you're my friend.
Well, I appreciate that.
With JB and Richard and Kirk and Scott and so many others, you're my friend. And you honored that friendship, if you will. I don't know what the right term is, but you substantiated my confidence and trust in you. By the way, you handled yourself exactly what I expected.
If you're dealing with
a religious hothead, they can't do what you did. A religious hothead is incapable of doing what you just did.
Well, it is what it is. I mean, you know, I made
perfect.
A mistake.
We all make mistakes. It's the way you responded that's important.
Good.
It's just a class act. The class act. Even Yahweh admitted to making a mistake. You know, he did. After he said, you know, I grieved over creating a man.
I do recall.
Yeah.
He said this could be a giant mistake, basically.
Yeah, I said, you know, I made a mistake in creating man. Because he's become nothing but a vicious killer. You know, look at this man.
I think about it.
Yeah, what did Yahweh say? Okay, I can fix this. I can resolve this. I can make this right. And he didn't shirk the responsibility. He went right in and fixed it. Cleaned up the mess.
Yep. Well, think about the mistakes you've made in your life. None of them compares to having created man.
Oh, no. Well, you know, I'm not going to go.
There's an upside to that,
with
though,
God
too.
Saying,
you know,
my mistakes are less than his mistakes. I'm not going there.
You're on your own there, pal.
Yeah, you're on. Yeah, you're on your own there, JB.
Let me ask one quick question, Yana. I have a grandchild. What color is her hair?
She was bald as a cue ball.
Right.
And then the hair was so thin it appeared blonde. But at this point, I would say it is most definitely going to be dark brown.
Dark brown, okay.
Dark brown. Her eyes are absolutely green. But my son has green eyes. My eldest son has green eyes, and his wife has green eyes. It's a double recessive.
Wow, that's so
rare. It was impossible for my granddaughter to have anything other than green eyes with a double recessive gene. So she has green eyes, and her hair is now coming in, and it is it's brown. And she is the most beautiful little girl in the world. I know that everybody thinks that, but that's my
view.
argue
with that.
Yeah, I'm sticking with it. She is the most beautiful, the sweetest little girl in the world. And by the way, I'm actually convinced of that. That's just the way it is. You know, I'm sure that everybody who's ever had a granddaughter feels exactly the same way. Yep.
Well, Yon, I'm glad we're all back together.
Yeah, I am too.
All right, pal.
Yeah, great experience. Thank you, fellas. And we'll finish the seventh proverb maybe next time. I can't wait to jump into Yashaya because, man, that has been a goldmine of insights.
Now, is that number seven or six?
I just finished seven. I'm going to, but this is five, so we're going to go. Yashaya chapter 1 is 6.
Okay.
7 is Yashaya chapter 2. And then 8, rather than going into Yashaya chapter 3 for 8, 8 mm-hmm. is actually, when I started to track down everything about Dodd and Solomon related to Zion and building the temple. I just found so many interesting nuggets as to God's relationship with these two individuals and what was important and what he said and why Dodd couldn't build the temple. And, you know, I always thought Dodd couldn't build the temple because of the time out that God gave him
right,
in association with his sexual indiscretion with Bathsheba. Nope. Wasn't it?
Well, I don't
and so I ended up learning so that got much as I was studying this. I'm going to write an entire chapter based upon God's interaction with Dodd and with Solomon. And I'm not a fan of Solomon. God happened to like Solomon. Personally, I don't. But God did. And God didn't like Solomon. It's interesting as to why God liked Solomon. And God said exactly why he liked him. And so, man, I'm going to devote chapter 8. I know it goes off the reservation. I wanted to follow Yasha all the way through. But I found so much stuff that I'm interested in learning and absorbing. Chapter 8 is going to be on God's conversations with Dodd and Solomon. No, you know why Dodd couldn't build the temple?
No, not really.
You'll never guess it. Never guess it. Because he was a man of war.
Well, he was a man of war. I was referring to the other.
The first thing that God says when he returns is that man will no longer have any implements of war and will no longer teach war. That's the first thing he says is going to be different. No war. No weapons, no war. And Dodd was a man of war. And so God says, I love you dearly, but you can't build my temple. You can't build my house. My house will not be a house of war. Didn't know that was the reason. So I thought that was fascinating. Why? Because what Yah was home all about, the doorway to life, right?
Right. Life next
to him. Dodd was, you know, he arose as the man who killed Goliath. And he fought innumerable battles after that. So there you go.
Makes sense. Makes sense.
And by the way, you know, when you're dealing with the F-bomb, boy, I'll tell you what, Dodd was an expert. I mean, you read about Dodd's first 7 children. There were 7 different mothers. And then you read about the next group of children, and he had 2 or 3 with one woman, but all the rest were with different women. And then God says, by the way, now I've listed like 10 or 12 or something like that, but I'm not going to even bother listing the ones that were with concubines.
Yeah, he was a busy man.
He was a busy man.
And he got so much war in there, huh?
Yeah, I mean, he was a lover and a fighter. I mean, yeah. Dodd did lots of stuff that God's not pleased with, but didn't matter because he was right. You're right with God.
He was right.
Doesn't matter if your behavior is bad.
Indeed.
Yeah, wonderful example. All right, guys. Well, thank you. Been fun.
Enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Thanks.
See you next week. Bye, Larry.
Bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Good night.